Okay, so Corky S, you are on.
Thank you, Charlie. Good morning, everybody, or good afternoon, as the case may be. My name is Corky Smith, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm honored to speak to this group. I should have said, piped up when you asked for anybody that's new to this meeting, which I am, but then I thought I'm going to be talking too much anyway, so I didn't say anything then, but I have not been to this meeting before. But I've been to a lot of meetings, and my sobriety date is Thursday, December the 16th, 1976. And my home group is the There Is a Solution group in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. And I have a sponsor, Jim S. in Cincinnati. And my story is not particularly unique, but just the fact that I've been around a number of years is not important to anybody other than me personally, but that somebody can stay sober for a number of years. My first sponsor, Keith B, just celebrated his 50th anniversary on February the 22nd. He lives in outside of Phoenix, and I talk to him on a semi-regular basis, but he was very important in those early days. So my story, there's it's my feeling there are four basic leads. There's the lead that you plan to give. There's the lead that you do give. There's the lead that you wish you'd given. And then there's the truth. And I say that facetiously in a way, but given the fact that I was a blackout drinker, I was a daily drinker, I was a scotch drinker, I was a bar drinker, and I was a blackout drinker. But so when you're in a blackout, obviously the only thing you know what happened is what somebody tells you. But even without the blackouts, the distortion of reality that alcohol imparts on our brains, in particular in the alcoholic, is the distortions and the away from reality is amazing. But anyway, I was born in a loving family as an only child in Dayton, Ohio, in 1938, and I started drinking with my parents' permission. In high school, they felt that it was fairly common that if you learned to drink at home and learned to drink responsibly, you'd never get into any problems with alcohol. And I had what I considered the hollow leg syndrome, and I assumed I would always have that. But I was totally wrong there. But anyway, I grew up in a medical family. My father was a physician. My grandfather was a physician. The man that married my father's sister was a physician. And my earliest remembrances, I learned to drive a car sitting on my dad's lap when I couldn't reach the pedals, making house calls with my dad. So I came by it naturally. And so as long as I can remember, I wanted to be a physician. And I had a lot of good years. My parents were scotch drinkers, and I was allowed to finish the highballs that they fixed. Neither one of them were alcoholics, I had a loving family. I did not have a dysfunctional family, and I had a lot of good years with alcohol, actually. I went to Brown University from high school in Dayton, and I was never athletic, but I was pledging fraternities there. And just to give you a little idea about my early drinking, I pledged one of the premier jock fraternities at Brown because they wanted me as their social chairman. So, you know, I was not, you know, in any way athletic, but they saw a bright future to have me as their social chairman. So that got off to a good start, and I loved being at Brown, and I was getting ready to go back to my junior year, and that would be in 1958. And just around Labor Day, about the time I was to leave, my mother started coughing up blood, and they worked her up, and they found a mass in her chest. And the general surgeon, who was a good friend of the family, opened my mother up and found a bronchogenic carcinoma that had invaded the wall of the aorta, and she was given 6 months to live. And my father and I were devastated, absolutely devastated. Now, my mother was a smoker, but what I remember was just kind of a social smoker. But I couldn't go back east to Providence, and I dropped out of school, and I took my mother to the local hospital in Dayton, Mama Valley Hospital, every day for massive radiation treatments. And the radiologist, you know, really gave her some massive treatments. And really, when she was first diagnosed, she was still feeling fine. This was just that she started with this hemoptysis of coughing up this blood. And following this radiation treatment, she was very sick from the radiation. But by the grace of God, she did get a little bit better. And I had been out of school for a while. And so I enrolled in the University of Dayton for a while. And then I transferred to the University of Cincinnati. And my mother actually lived for 2 years from the first time they diagnosed it because of this treatment that the radiologist gave my mother. But I was just, you know, devastated, and I really didn't. I started drinking more, I was a Scotch drinker. I didn't go through the beer and 7 and 7 routine, and you know, I really didn't. I was kind of in a limbo for a while there, not knowing. And my mom was getting a little better. And then the last 6 months were horrible. And she died of a slow, horrible, asphyxiating death from her tumor. And at that time, I had been admitted to the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. And so during the day and during the week, I was dissecting a cadaver with three other students, and on the weekends I would drive back 50 miles to my home and be with my mother and father and see her become cachectic, have trouble breathing and unable to move. And it was a horrible, horrible time. And the drinking escalated, and I wanted to drop out of medical school. And my father kept insisting that I hang in there. And to that end, he and I took a couple of wonderful trips to Europe in the summertime between my junior and freshman and sophomore year and sophomore and junior year. And so by the grace of God, I hung in there, and I graduated from medical school in 1964. I graduated on a Saturday, and on Sunday I went to Columbus and took the Ohio State Medical Board exams for 3 days, mostly oral, some written, and came back on Friday and had my bachelor dinner. And the week after I graduated from medical school, I got married, pretty much hungover from my bachelor dinner, and then went to Chicago to intern. And I interned in Chicago at Northwestern. I wanted to, my father and my grandfather and my uncle were all in general practice. And I medical school, a lot of us find the field we want by process of elimination. And I knew I didn't want this and I didn't want that. I didn't want pediatrics. I didn't want obstetrics. I didn't want radiology. That time, radiology was just primarily looking at x-rays in a box. It wasn't the interventional and patient contact that it is today. So, but anyway, I narrowed it down to neurology and ophthalmology, and I decided I would go into ophthalmology and specialize in just the diseases and surgery of the eye. And it was a wonderful decision for me. I enjoyed every minute of practice. After I finished my residency in 1968, Uncle Sam stepped in, and I had been deferred. And so he decided that they deferred me as long as they could. And I went on active duty and was sent to Fort Huachuca, Arizona. And I spent 2 years there. And I was seeing a lot of the docs that go through there on their way to Vietnam. This was 68 to 70. And I was fortunate to, there was an old, one-story hospital in Douglas, Arizona, which was about an hour away from Fort Huachuca. And the ear, nose, and throat doctor, Charlie Meinstein from Phoenix, and I, every Wednesday, with the Army's permission, would drive down to this little hospital. And there was an old ENT doctor down there who was too old to do surgery anymore. But he was in his 70s at that time. And Charlie and I would go down there, and they had two operating rooms. And Charlie would do ear, nose, and throat surgery in one room, and I'd do eye surgery in the other room. And so the Army did not send either one of us to Nam. And I don't know this for a fact, but I think that part of it was that we were doing this moonlighting, and we had patients from deep into Mexico. We had neither he, Charlie, nor I spoke Spanish, and we had interpreters in the operating rooms. And this old ENT doctor, he would work up the patients beforehand, and he'd follow them postoperatively. So it was a wonderful, wonderful professional experience for both he and I. And that Charlie wanted me to come to Phoenix and practice when I got out. And I looked at a lot of places. I love San Diego, but it was very saturated with physicians. And he had a good friend in San Antonio, and he wanted me to come down there. And I went back to Cincinnati, hung out my shingle in 1970. And drinking was still, you know, was still under control, you know. I was working hard, and I was drinking, but I was not, I was not seeing any of the ill effects as yet. So I hung out my shingle in Cincinnati and started practice in 1970. And for the next 6 years, you know, things really started to go downhill. I had neglected to say that just before I went into the military, my wife and I adopted our first child, who was a little girl. We had no, we adopted through the state of Ohio through a private adoption, a private OB, and a private attorney, which was very legal at that time. We adopted our first child. We didn't know what the sex, we didn't specify, because we didn't know till the child was born whether we were going to have a little boy or a little girl. So we adopted our first daughter before I started active duty. And when I got out, we adopted our second child, again, not knowing the sex, that was also a little girl. So I started in practice in 1970 with a family, a couple, a loving wife, two wonderful daughters, and a practice that was supposed to be three of us, but the oldest gentleman dropped over from a heart attack before I got there from exiting the army, and the other ophthalmologist there went on the Good Ship Hope as a mission for a month. So I had a three-man practice, that I was trying to take care of right out of the army. And so I got off to this unbelievable start. So the thing that my drinking was escalating, but it was still what I thought under control. And I never thought that alcohol was going to be that much of a problem for me. My father had warned me about the dangers of narcotics and addiction and other medications, but he never considered the problem with alcoholism. And so I started. I got what I had always been denied. I always had everything I ever wanted, materialistically and lovingly, and. But I never had a motorcycle. So the thing I wanted to get at that point was a motorcycle. So, and I was a bar drinker, and I'd stop at the bars on the way home, and I'd ride my motorcycle to the office. And then once you start, your hollow leg syndrome starts to disappear, you start to exude, you start to smell of the booze. And so it was not appropriate to make rounds back. And back in those days, cataract patients, my patients were in 5 days in the hospital. It wasn't an outpatient, an hour and a half procedure, in and out in an hour and a half. So 5 days, I had to make rounds and change dressings. And if you go in at 6 or 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning and you smell like a brewery, that's not a good thing. So I would. Make midnight rounds, and I'd be sitting at the bar and waiting, having a few drinks to get ready to make rounds, and I'd go to the hospitals, and I'd have to wake up my patients and change these dressings and make sure everything was all right, and then get back and frequently I'd also have to be sitting at the bar and. Somebody, one of the guys, the emergency room hospitals around there, had called me, and the guy had a piece of steel in his eye, and working on the cars and everything. And I'd go the next day I wouldn't remember that I had seen this guy the night before and taken the steel out. And I'd go in the next day and I'd introduce myself, and he'd say, "Don't you remember? That you saw me last night," and it was very embarrassing. So the doctors in the emergency rooms put on eye patches any old way, and so I developed a technique where I had the tape torn exactly the same length, and I put them on the over the iPad and the shield, at a certain angle, so I could walk in the next day. And I could look at that patch and know if that was my patch or not. So I would know whether to introduce myself to that patient and avoid all that unnecessary embarrassment. So those were the little tricks that were starting to show up. It was people, nobody said, "You're an alcoholic." My wife said, "You drink too much," and my kid said, "You drink too much," and my colleague said, "You drink too much," so I'd be sitting at the bar next to a stranger, and we'd both be sitting there drinking, and I'd tell him that, and I'd say, "My wife says I drink too much," and my kids and my colleagues, I said, "Do you think I drink too much?" He said, "No, you don't drink too much," and so he's the one I believed. I didn't It's all a matter of, for, context. So things deteriorated, and I wrecked the motorcycle. I ended up in the hospital with broken ribs and a fractured confidence on the motorcycle, and they were watching for the DTs, and they let me out. but I continued to drink, and I was trying to get back to a New Year's resolution. I had quit the previous January for I went on the wagon to prove, you know, everybody was on my case, and I went on the wagon. Now I didn't realize that social drinkers never go on the wagon to prove they're social drinkers. You know, it's the alcoholic that goes on the wagon to prove that they're not an alcoholic. But I lasted about 3 months, and I got down to Florida with my kids and started drinking those yellow birds at the pool, Fats Brew pool, and the motel in Fort Lauderdale, and I was off and running again. So I was having blackouts, terrible hangovers. My wife was spending so much money on the Johnny Walker, and I'd had it delivered by the case from Northern Kentucky, and I would buy it from the state stores in Ohio, and I was drinking plenty of Scotch whiskey, but I was rarely drunk. I was rarely staggering drunk. I wanted to be controlled. I wanted that control, that titrate that Scotch just so that I'm mellow and not drunk. So the times that I was staggering drunk, I think probably could be counted on both of my hands. But the times I drove under the influence were almost all the time. And yet, by the grace of God, I never had a DUI. So I finally was trying to get back to going on the wagon. And I got back to December the 16th, and my kids were home from, they were 6 and 9 at the time. They were home for getting ready for Christmas. And I couldn't get that drink down, that morning drink that I had fixed when I came home and closed the bars and put it beside the bed, and it was melted. It's just kind of Scotch and some melted ice. And I couldn't get it down. I just couldn't get it down. So I went to my physician, and he admitted me to the hospital that I did most of my work at. And for 5 days, I was in detox, and I wanted to go home and be with my kids. And they said, no, you need more treatment. So they sent me to a treatment center in Cincinnati for a month. I was in over Christmas and New Year's, and my wife, fortunately, who was ready to disown me and suitcase me, it brought the kids in almost every day to see me, and that was very special. When I got out, I was introduced to AA in the treatment center. I couldn't believe why some people would come in and share their experience, strength, and hope to a bunch of strangers. We were there as patients, inpatients, in our hospital gowns and paper slippers, and these people would come in and tell their stories and their innermost problems and personal, such a personal level, and it was impressive. It was so impressive. And part of the aftercare plan of the treatment center was to come back to the AA, come back to the outpatient meetings and go to AA, and I did that. And so I started going. I got out in mid-January of 1977, and in Cincinnati, that was the most bitter, lowest temperatures recorded in Cincinnati history was in January of 1977. The Ohio River froze over. People were walking across to Kentucky on the river. And I started going to my AA meetings at that point, and Keith got a hold of me, Keith B, and he appointed himself as my first sponsor because he told me I was totally incapable of making a choice or making a decision about, you know, choosing a sponsor. But he was a wonderful sponsor, and he helped me and a lot of other, pigeons get off to a good start. And so sobriety was through a lot of meetings and a lot of sponsorship and a lot of fellowship and it was good, and I took to it, and I loved it, and I'm still going to meetings at my age. I'll be 85 in a couple of months, and I still enjoy going to the meetings, and I need to do that because just because I lived it doesn't mean I can't forget it, all that happened to me. But in sobriety, I've had 8 major operations, 4 in the first 20 years, 4 lumbar laminectomies on my lower spine at different levels with herniated discs, and then 4 operations in the last 20 years, primarily fractured leg with plates, plate and screws, and fortunately a benign parathyroid adenoma, and then a couple of cataracts with implants. Really strange, I'll tell you, to be lying on the table and having your cataract removed when you've been on the giving side, on the other side of that thing for a long time. That to be on the receiving side instead of the, giving side was a real experience. But fortunately, it worked out well. And today, the cataract surgery is so much different than it was when I started. And I retired in 2015. I practiced for 47 years, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. Ophthalmology was good for me, and think I was good for it. But I walked out. I was in a big group. I started out, in a 2-person practice, and really was solo for a long time. And then the last several years, I was in a large group. And so when I retired, the group is still going strong in Cincinnati. And but I haven't missed. I when I was in it, I loved it, but I haven't really missed it. And I came over here to Central Pennsylvania. I had my 30-year marriage ended in divorce. Even though I had been sober several years, my wife at the time, her drinking escalated, and I never could successfully get to Al-Anon, so that and the other reasons our marriage ended, and then I was single for a while, and then I had a long-term relationship with a nurse from the hospital, and she and I broke up in 2020, and that was partly because she was quite a bit younger than I was. And so she said, "Why don't you go live with your kids?" And I was very fortunate that my girls have always been so pro my recovery, and so it was a logical thing. I moved over here with my younger daughter for the first couple of years in Mechanicsburg, and then I've been since Christmas. I've been here in Lititz with my older daughter and her husband and my granddaughter. So. And I've gotten in-person meetings in both locations, and it's all good. So, that's kind of my story. I wanted to just give you some couple of personal opinions about things. These are not party line AA by any means, but the most important person in a meeting to me is the person who has gone back out and had a slip and has come back in. And the reason I say that is because if everybody that went back out we never saw them again, even if they all died or never got back, I might think that it's okay out there, that they're having a good time. And it's all right to do that. But I've never heard anybody come back from a slip and say what a good time they had. So the fact that they come back and tell us exactly how it was and how it picks up right where it was start left off is fascinating and powerful, and I appreciate that. And so people that come back and share that, are to me so important. Also, early on, I did what a lot of people, I'm not even sure if this is in the literature, but they say, you know, if you're not sure, go back out and try some controlled drinking for a while. And I used to tell people that, but I don't do that anymore because there probably has been a non-alcoholic get to an AA meeting in the past, but almost everybody that ever gets in through the door to an AA meeting is pretty much an alcoholic if they get to that point. And if they go back out, if they get in the door, I want them to stay. I want to encourage them to stay. I don't want to tell them to go out and do some controlled drinking because they may not get back. And I don't want that on my conscience. So for me, I don't tell anybody to go out and do any controlled drinking. The other thing is I had a lot of people go through, besides the surgeries, I went through a divorce and a bankruptcy. But a lot of people do that. But I went through a clinical depression, and I had to seek professional care and be on a medication for a year, and then weaned off and off for a year and put back on, and then it was removed again. And for many years, I said drinking isn't an option. I told myself drinking isn't an option, and I told myself that so long and so often that when I was in that clinical depression and drinking was a real possibility, it almost overcame me. So I don't say anymore that drinking is not an option. I say I have to face the fact that drinking is an option every day and that I don't want to use that. I don't want to take that option because if I deny it and bury it, it could rise up in at some point and overcome me. So I say, you know, drinking is an option and I don't want to exercise it. And my first sponsor, Keith, always said, he gave me some advice very early, which is probably some of the best advice I ever got. He said, always be a learner. He says, never be a teacher. Always be a learner because the teachers are the ones that go back out and show how this thing works. And so he was right on. He, as I said, he just celebrated 50 years, February the 22nd. And he helped me tremendously. And I've had a few wonderful sponsors over the years. I come back and I see Charlie on a regular. Charlie's pretty regular. I'm not so regular, but on a basis there in our Caduceus group in Cincinnati. And I appreciate his inviting me to share a little bit today. And I'm going to wind it up and turn it back to Charlie. Thank you.